Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Moll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, what was really behind the Libyan revolution to oust Colonel Gaddafi and the U.S. strategy to use Islamic terrorists? What happened? We've never been told the truth. In fact, we haven't been told anything except we liberated a country from a dictator. We're going to examine that in depth with James and Joanne Moriarty. They're successful business people. They had lived in Libya from 2007 until the overthrow and death of General Gaddafi in 2011. While in Libya, their product provided enzymes to rejuvenate oil wells and clean up sludge pits, and that earned a lot of money, about $5 billion. And they were in the midst of building a manufacturing facility when the revolution began. And during the rioting and collapse of the Gaddafi government and the new rule of radical Islamic factions, they and other foreigners attempted to leave on a rescue ship and were captured and held by Al-Qaeda militant types. Then eventually they were released. They have produced a lot of information on their ordeal, including a video entitled Escape from Al-Qaeda, which includes evidence of the U.S. and its allies planning of a forced coup well in advance. Their website is LibyanWarTheTruth.com. Now, some of their statements were so phenomenal that we had to have independent verification that these people were telling us the truth. Now, today, we received a letter from Libya from a group of tribal leaders, and it says, to whom it may concern. James and Joanne Moriarty are close friends of the tribes of Libya and the Libyan people, and as the supreme leader of all the tribes of Libya, it is my honor to appoint them as official spokespersons. James and Joanne have stood by the tribes of Libya in our hour of need and understand our culture as well. We ask them to continue our efforts to help the tribes of Libya bring peace to our people. Please afford James and Joanne with the same position of honor and respect you would show me personally. And this is from the Vice Libyan Leader Tribe's office, Aslim Abu Shreda. So we also looked at all the documents. We looked at all the facts we could collect, because what you're about to hear would otherwise seem improbable, if not impossible. First, I want to go into life under Gaddafi and then life under today, after the revolution and the U.S. installation of Islamic government, and which some have said is more like a mafia-type contingent. I'd like for you to examine this in detail, and the reason is this. We've been led to believe that Gaddafi was a ruthless dictator, and he ran his country as if it was his own private domain. He looted it, he exploited the people, and hence Hillary Clinton and other neocons decided it was important, as it had been to eliminate Saddam Hussein from Iraq, to eliminate him, to bring democracy and freedom and a sense of a new purpose to the people of Libya. That's what we were told. So I'd like for you to both go through what Libya was like for the people of Libya, for the different tribes of Libya, where you saw the strengths and weaknesses of Gaddafi and his regime, and what Libya was like to live in as a foreigner. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Gary, thank you so much for having us on your show. We're honored to be your guests, and we hope that we can pass out enough information so your audience can begin to open their eyes and have a different look about what the media might be telling that's not true.
Hi, Gary. This is Joanne. It's so nice to be with you. We'll be happy to give you all the information we have, and we know it from our eyewitness account.
Now then, first of all, we're business people. We're not political activists. Never had been until we were forced into this position in Libya. And we have international production marketing rights for proprietary technologies that we produce custom enzymes that rejuvenate oil wells and clean up pipelines and sludge pits. And we first went to Libya on the 1st of January 2007, shortly after the treaty was signed between the United States and Libya. And not knowing Libya other than what the news had told us, we took a contingent of security people with us, four great big guys, one at each corner of us. And we'd planned to look at Libya because they had been locked out of any new technologies for 38 years because of the embargoes. After we'd been there 2 days, we sent our contingent, our security people home. We didn't need them. First time in over 30 years that we went to a new country and everybody smiled and was happy to see us and gave us a thumbs up. And we're glad the United States is here. Can we help you? Do you like our country, et cetera? So instead of being a 5-day trip, we were asked to stay over because the Libyan people and the government of Libya wanted to know how business was done outside of Libya. And we stayed an extra 10 days. We actually met with many ministers, told them how business was done. In the end, we signed a contract on that first trip in there to rejuvenate 2,500 monster oil wells, which would have been about $600 million to $1 billion worth of our product. That was first trip in. Anybody, any company of any size would have considered that a Grand Slam home run. So we then went to try to put production plants in place to subordinate those contracts. And we were in Libya from January 2007 until February 2011. We were in Libya 17 times. We were there never less than 30 days at a time, sometimes 3 months or more. And in those following 4 years, we signed additional contracts, which totaled about $5 billion worth of our products. In January of 2011, we signed a joint venture agreement with one of the Social Security investment funds in Libya. And all of their pensioners were retirees from the oil and gas industry. So we had perfect partners to do the political side of our business in Libya. We moved in about $200 million worth of product and funds and feedstock and everything in order to build a new plant. And we were locating that plant in the new free zone, which was going to be located near the Tunisian border. I left there on the 8th of January, 2011. Within 10 days, the fighting started, and it was absolutely a coup d'etat. The people of Libya were happy, and let me explain what their life was like. Nobody had any debt. Libya went from the lowest income, lowest developed country in 1965 to the highest developed, highest standard of living, highest salaried country in Africa in those 38 years. While Gaddafi was the ruler. And in 2006, the treaty required him to step down from power, which he did. And there was another government leader. His name was Baghdadi. And we'll get into what the problems with him were. But the people in Libya, $15,800 a year average salary. Your first car cost you half of dealer invoice. The day you got married, the government gave you a gift of $46,000. Each child you had, the government gave you a gift of $5,000. Your home cost you 10% of your salary for 20 years, and then it was yours. And while you were, for your entire life, the utilities were paid by the government. Gasoline was 44 cents a gallon. Medical was paid, and if you could not get the medical treatment you needed in Libya, the government paid for you to have your medical treatment done anywhere in the world, and they not only paid your medical costs, but they paid your travel costs and expenses and a family member to go with you. Education was fully paid to the extent your brain would support, and we knew a young man that was getting his doctorate in England. He had a wife and 4 kids. Besides all of his tuition fees, books, et cetera, he was paid a monthly stipend of £4,950 while he was in university. If you were a bad businessman and you didn't have enough food for your family, there were storehouses all over the country. You could go up to any of those storehouses without ID. They would give you 50 kilos of rice, 50 kilos of flour, 20 kilos of cheese, powdered milk, and enough money to have an animal slaughtered for your family. Nobody had any debt. The government had no debt. The government of Libya at that time had $241 billion in cash and cash equivalents in the Federal Reserve System here. They had 150 billion euros in Euroclear. They had 39 billion in cash in Libya. They had 179 tons of gold. They had 2,000 tons of silver and many, many other tons of rare earths, heavy earths, and precious metals.
Yeah, Gary, let me talk a minute about the people of Libya. There's only about six. There were only 6 million people in Libya. They're a very soft people, really. They're naive. They're not a fighting type of a people. But Libya was the most progressive Muslim country in the world. All religions with a book were welcome there and protected there. Women were emancipated in the 1970s by Gaddafi. Women were in the military. They were they owned their own businesses. They were doctors, lawyers. They were in the government. They were really free to do what they wanted, and they had better protection under Libyan law, under divorce, than we have in the United States. The thing about Gaddafi, and we never met Gaddafi personally. We learned about who he was through the hearts and minds of the Libyan people. We were in Tripoli for 100 days during the NATO war with the tribes and with other groups. And we saw 2 million Libyans come together in Green Square to support their government and profess the love for their what they call their guide. They called the Gaddafi their guide. I would have to say 85% of all the Libyan people loved him. And this was the biggest war crime of all, that this kind of lie was put out against these people who did not want this war and who did not want to lose their leader. Gaddafi's gift was, his biggest gift was not only the bloodless coup when the old king ran off in 1969, but Libya being the poorest country in Africa at that time, he brought the tribes together. The problem with Libya in the past was that there were pieces of them that warred all the time. They didn't fight, but they were against each other. They didn't agree on things. They kept their areas private. And he was able to bring all the tribes together under one umbrella and make Libya a completely sovereign country the first time in its history over 8,000 years.
Now, there are about 2,000 tribes in Libya. The largest one was almost 2 million people. Some of the smaller tribes, 10 or 12 people. But the Libyan tribes actually were half of the government of Libya. The general secretary of the tribes, 200 members strong, were elected from the smallest tribe all the way up. They were half of the government. They were the shadow portion of the government. The general Congress had about 350 elected members, and those were the two legs of the Libyan government. And
it was a complete democracy. I mean, to say we brought freedom and democracy to them is a farce, because the tribal system is a bit like you could go back to a town hall meeting in a small village where they go and they talk to their tribal leaders about the problem. Those tribal leaders go to the next level up to the, finally they get to the general secretariat with that problem. If it's not solved by then, it goes to the government. But that's exact representation that people want to talk about in democracy that was destroyed in Libya by NATO.
There was never any democracy brought to Libya, and there was never any revolution. There were about 5% of Libyans that were radical, psychopathic Islamists. And they were from the Derna East section, and they'd been in jail a long time. The United States and other...
Gaddafi would not allow it.
He wouldn't allow radical Islamists in his country. If you had a long beard and mustache, you couldn't hardly get a job. And the part of the Quran that was added by the Ayatollah Khomeini while he was in exile in France... Gaddafi would not allow that to be added to their Quran. He wouldn't allow it to be taught. And for that reason, the radicals called him a non-Muslim and put a killing fatwa out on him that lasted for 20 years. And so he was kind of a different character, you know.
He was the African Union guy.
He was. He supported the African Union. Libya did all kinds of first world activities to third world countries in Africa. He supplied them water wells and cement plants and things like that that none of us ever heard about. And but regardless of that, we stayed away from Gaddafi and his family because we didn't know the truth about him until we were there. We were asked to head an NGO fact-finding commission, and we were there in Tripoli from early May through the end of August. And the reason al-Qaeda captured us and had us on their kill list was because we had the audacity to openly tell the people of Libya that they had the right to determine their own government. And Joanne and I are not traitors. We love the United States. But what we are is we're eyewitnesses to war crimes and atrocities that were perpetrated by the U.S., UN, NATO in Libya. We're eyewitnesses. This is not something that somebody told us. We were there. We saw more bombing sorties in Libya than occurred in World War II combined. More bombs dropped. Hospitals were blown up, clinics, water treatment plants, power plants, universities, all these things which are not allowed under any stretching the imagination under any Geneva Convention or anything. And the only thing that the UN ever authorized was to establish a no-fly zone.
And Libya, which was a progressive country that was free and the people were enjoying their lives, is now in a terrible mess. The NATO had to bring in 250,000 Al-Qaeda mercenaries to take over that country because the Libyan people did not want to change their government.
In the first week of February 2011, U.S. Department of Defense declared Gaddafi the best ally the United States had in the war against radical Islamists.
Terrorists.
And 2 weeks later, we're bombing them and blowing that country to oblivion. So the truth is out there. If you all will just open your eyes and look at it. You know, the thing that we know is if we don't stand our ground now, soon we'll not have any ground to stand on. And,
hold on. You've made some statements now. Tell me what you heard about Gaddafi that would be putting it into some balance, because you're making him seem as if he was the most benevolent and democratic and progressive leader within the entire Arab League, and that is not always the accurate case. What were his limitations? What were his negatives?
Well, the negatives were that the biggest problem in Libya was the Misrata tribe. And those they had moved from Turkey to Libya in about 150 years ago. They were originally Jews in Turkey. They converted to Islam, supposedly, and moved into Misrata. And they were a real belligerent bunch of people. The Libyans were non-confrontational.
They were the mafia.
And those guys were mafia. And they absolutely dominated all the contracts and everything. They used threat and coercion and everything else. 60% of all the contracts that were let in Libya went to the Misrata mafia without tender or bid. And the other 40% were handled in a normal manner. And that was released to them to quell their demands. But, you know, that was a real error on the part of Gaddafi. But, you know, being tribal and trying to control 2,000 tribes is a tough thing. We're not trying to say Gaddafi was good, bad, or indifferent, but the people of Libya
are the ones who
love
told
the
us
guy.
These things. We've heard from other people in Libya who've told us that, well, he abused my family, he picked up my brother and put him in jail and these other things, and that's probably true. There are people who feel like they were abused by him, but nothing like was ever reported. There were 1,200 prisoners that disappeared. This is something they talked about during the war in the East. Those 1,200 that disappeared were radical Islamists that went house to house and killed and chopped up women and children who did not join their radical Islam.
These were from 1985 to about 1996 something.
Yeah. Those 1,200 people were captured or were, you know, put in prison.
And they disappeared.
That's a big complaint of those radical Islamists. Where are those people? But I have to say, the radical Islamists have killed Libyans and tortured them to death. So, you know, you have to look at both sides of that. Now, Gaddafi, he had a lot of interesting beliefs. A lot of people think he was out there on the edge, but I don't know. I can't say because I never met the man.
We never did business with him because, just like you and us and everybody else, we heard the stories from the media over here. But it's now been proven he had nothing to do with Lockerbie. He had nothing to do with the bombing of the discotheque in London. The police officer that was shot in front of the Libyan embassy, all those things were false flag operations perpetrated by the intelligence agencies, three of them, US, CIA, MI5, and Mossad. And all those have been proven. That's all been brought up to public record now.
James, I need you just to hold it for a moment here because I want to segue a little bit. We have independently confirmed, and there is an award-winning documentary that supports that Gaddafi was not behind the Lockerbie bombing. I believe that is more than supported, that no one can absolutely say that, oh, it was Gaddafi. We know that there are individuals that when they no longer serve the purposes of the United States or Great Britain or France are targeted, and they do use false flag operations. The Gulf of Tonkin was a false flag operation that got us into Vietnam. Weapons of mass destruction, you know, that got us into Iraq. From what I'm told from scholars that we have interviewed prior to today's program, that Gaddafi kept his military small because he feared a coup. He did impose a secular society. Yeah, child marriage was banned, which is good. Women had equal rights and pay, and they were able to divorce men without a hassle. Homelessness was insignificant, but unemployment was 13% at the time of the revolution. Literacy was 88%, and life expectancy rose from 52 years of age to 77 during his rule. He had the highest average salaries of any country in Africa, greater than China and India. Its UN humanitarian, what is called UN Human Development Index, was the highest in Africa, which is a positive. But its corruption index was among the worst, which is a negative. And you're referring to this kind of mafia from this tribe that had undue influence. Gaddafi had also planned, according to the experts, in 2008 to dissolve most of the government bureaucracy and ministries to give more direct government control to the Libyans because of mismanagement and corruption. And he was planning to give all the oil revenues directly to the population, but this was thwarted by the ministries, the General People's Congress, run by bureaucrats. So this at least gives us a picture that doesn't praise Gaddafi as much as it shows that under his rule, there was a quality of life for the Libyan people and the outreach to other African countries that was simply not applicable to Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Yemen, Egypt, and other countries. And yet all that was negated. The picture painted was so devastatingly dark, so demonic, that he was pictured as just this patently evil person right there with Hitler, yet history does not show that to be the case. He was no angel by any measure, and he was a megalomaniac and an extreme narcissist, but then again, so have been most of our own presidents. So that at least establishes that we have been misled for some other intent. Now we have to look deeper. So who were the groups or individuals who ultimately took over the rule of Libya? For example, who comprises the National Transitional Council that the UN installed as the legal ruling entity? And then if radical Islam only made up approximately, as you said, 5%, I was told 3% of the Libyan population, then who were all the people we witnessed on our television celebrating the fall of Gaddafi? Let's take that part first.
Okay, let me identify why Libya was a target. The United States is bound and determined to have a war with China and Russia, and they wanted to have military control of Africa, again, because of natural resources. So U.S. established AFRICOM. And Libya, South Africa, and six other countries said, under no circumstances will we ever turn over military control of our country to anybody. So for that reason, the United States wanted to take him out. And then Gaddafi had put together a lawsuit on behalf of the African Union against all the imperialist countries that had taken over African countries and signed treaties with them and made agreements with them and then never complied with anything. And he included the 38 years of illegal embargo that he considered that Libya had suffered. And the lawsuit was for $7 trillion, and he had presented it to international court, and as the attorney said, it had legs. Now, this included Italy, France, England, Germany, all the countries that were in terrible financial shape, Spain. They could not afford any kind of payment in that area. So, of course, those countries were willing participants in this coup d'etat in Libya. Now, you add to that the fact that Libya has the fifth largest reserves of oil and gas in the world, and their Bonny Light is some of the best oil in the world. It's no sulfur, no contaminants, 55 gravity oil, real light. You can almost take it out of the ground and put it in your crankcase. It does have a high paraffin content, but that can be dealt with. There are refineries in Germany and France that can only process that Bonny Light. So the need for the Libyan oil in Germany and France was a real need for those countries. But those are the reasons. Here was a country that was ripe for the picking. Not many people. Not many people knew about it. It was a closed country. They had no tourism, only about 380,000 a year. Most of those were oil field workers. So nobody knew about Libya. They had sold this lie about how bad Libya was to the world. So it was an easy target.
Gaddafi was required to cut his military in half by the treaty that he signed with Condoleezza Rice in 2006. That was a requirement of that treaty.
There was another treaty signed in 2009. He had to reduce his military by another 50%. In the first treaty, he had to get rid of all of his offensive weapons. And in the treaty of 2009, Libya agreed to get rid of most of its defensive weapons. And the only condition put forward by Libya was that the United States agreed to protect Libya in the case they were invaded. Little did they know the U.S. was going to be lead in the invasion. So there was a real nasty game played there. And the benefit to the perpetrators of this coup d'etat are quite dramatic. The gold of Libya has disappeared. All their money's disappeared. It's the first time in history that a group of ragtag revolutionaries established a central bank within 4 or 5 days of them starting the revolution. And immediately that bank was recognized by the Federal Reserve and by Euroclear and the other banks. And then the money of Libya was delivered, if you would, to Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Sharia, et cetera.
People who now own that country, trying to control it. It's in the beginning, they know, the Libyans know, that the snipers that shot the protesters in the street that actually supposedly fomented this revolution were Qatar. They were from Qatar. And those snipers disappeared shortly thereafter.
In the war games, they were going to establish no-fly zone first, and then they were going to follow up with internal strife and conflict, et cetera. And the date for that to begin was March 18th. It actually started on February 18th. But it's very detailed about the war games. And the military people that were involved in that said that these kinds of takeovers or attacks have to be planned a long time in advance. You can't just roll 11 battleships and carriers and stuff into the Mediterranean overnight.
Let's look at what we have before us to see what makes sense and what does not. What can be proven, what cannot. You're saying that the Gaddafi ouster was necessitated because he had a $7 trillion lawsuit against Western nations for all of its broken treaties and atrocities Europeans committed upon Africans, not just Libya, and that very much like Venezuela's Hugo Chavez was for Latin America, Gaddafi was for Africa. You're also suggesting that Gaddafi had ruled things in his own personal way over a secular, oil-rich nation and had never really bothered anyone. And therefore, he had resources, he had assets, but he was also threatening with this bank that would be all of its resources be backed by gold. And since it had no debt and a small number of people living there, that it was one of the seven nations that had been planned back in the 1990s to take over. And those also included Libya and Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq, and also Iran. And this was all part of that, and that was their motivation. Now, that is what you're telling us, and we can either believe or disbelieve that, but that's what you're putting out there. You've also mentioned just now that there's over 2 million Libyans out of 6 forced into exile after the coup, and you're continuing to be in touch with tribal leaders, almost all who supported the Gaddafi government. But this is where we need to clear up a little confusion given by the U.S. media about Libya as a nation of endless tribal feuds. What do the tribes say now about the radical change in the government and direction of the country since the coup?
Well, the tribes have come together. There's a couple tribes that still are a little bit on the outside. Zintan is one of them. Some inside the Zintan tribe have joined the Libyan Tribal Military Council. But all the rest of the tribes have come together, and they have a complete plan to try to take their country back. They already have a constitution written that was actually written in August of 2011. That constitution would have been presented to the government and to NATO had they not gone in and blown up Tripoli at that time. The tribes are working together and have been working together with the new government in Tobruk. You know, in Libya, there's two governments right now, one illegitimate and one legitimate. The elected government is in the eastern city of Tobruk. That's a city that they had a election in 2014 in June. The GNC, which is in Tripoli, the other government, General National Congress, is the what I call the puppet government because it was put in place by NATO. And it is filled with Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Sharia, radical Islamists. And they were to step down last February. They stayed temporarily on until the election. When they lost the election, they refused to close the government. So they are running illegitimately, and they are being held up by Misrata militia. They call themselves militia, but really they're just street gangs with guns that threaten people, break into their homes. They're the ones that blew up the airport. These are the radicals that they want to get rid of. They want to clean their country of this and start over. The tribes do. And the tribes have set up a military council for this. And the Tobruk government has now the National Congress or the National Government, what I'm trying to say is the National Army of Libya is being reinstated. And that army stands with the tribes. So that's the country of Libya trying to clean itself of these radicals and put back in their democracy.
But you also need to understand that there are 250,000 to 400,000 mercenaries in Libya. That's who makes up the majority of the people fighting against the Libyan people.
Almost all the militias, the Misrata, I call them terrorists, in and around Tripoli are made up of mercenaries from Egypt, Yemen, Tunisia, Algeria, all those countries. The borders are open. They flow in and out. Algeria has recently closed its border, and they captured yesterday 10 fighters coming from Syria to try to fight with these militias.
And the thing that I want your audience to appreciate is that we were thrust in this position. Originally, we were trying to help Libya so that we'd get our business back online. And in the end, we saw these atrocities, and we just could not shut up about it. You know, it was the truth. And then a CIA agent, unbeknownst to us, told us if we didn't shut up about Libya, that we would disappear. And her exact words were, you need to forget about Libya and start your life over today, or you won't have a life. And I said, that sounds like a threat. She raised her voice, and she said, you stand down, do exactly what I'm telling you, or you won't have a life. And she's the one that told us that we had been blacklisted and soft-killed beginning in September of 2011 when we came back into the United States. And incidentally, we were not released by Al-Qaeda. We were extracted by three miracles. That's how we got out of their torture center in Libya. And then another miracle got us onto a rescue ship that took us to Benghazi. And then from Benghazi, a third miracle got us out of Libya.
What happened?
The driver, let me back up. The man that was head of IT at the Corinthia Hotel, that was the hotel we stayed at there. He spoke perfect English. He was never very friendly. But the day that the rescue ship was coming in, actually the Russian ambassador put our names on the list to be accepted because that ship was picking up dignitaries and other folks that were trapped inside Tripoli. And he called us and he said, I know you're getting no support from your government. Would you like me to put your name on that list? This was a rescue ship coming from Malta. We said, sure. After that, we had five other people approach us and ask us if they could possibly go with us. We called his office. They added their names to the list. And then the hotel agreed to loan us their van and a driver and a man to ride shotgun so that we could get through the checkpoints. Every 100 meters, there was a checkpoint of Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, armed gangs, and they would look at every car passing and check their credentials, et cetera. And so this car was taking us to the rescue ship. Unfortunately, we didn't know that the rescue ship had been fired on and was moored 3 miles out. And so we were going up and down the coast road, again, every 100 meters being stopped and questioned, and the driver was telling that we were reporters. And they liked reporters because the reporters had been lying for them for all that time. So they would Allah Akbar and shoot in the air. One time this one young man shot at the ground. It bounced up and knocked out the back window in the van. But we were all day trying to find the rescue ship. And the second time we went back into the port of Tripoli, we were in there about an hour And we were held in there. We didn't know why. All of a sudden, about 20 or 30 vehicles pulled in there, and we had 50 to 100 AK-47s in our face. And one big, tall guy, big, hard-looking character came in. He had a sheet of paper with our names on it. He said, "The game is up. We know who you are." And then they took us to the Radisson Blue, which was the Mahari, which had been converted into their torture center. No electricity, no lights, no water, nothing. And we were held in the lobby, and they would be they were bringing in wounded soldiers, taking them up to the mezzanine.
They took all of our documentation, all of our everything. They took it all.
And after we were there a long time, this big, tall, fat, bearded imam came in. Came in, looked down his nose at us, said something in Arabic, and walked off. And then within 15 minutes, this IT man from the Corinthia came over and said he was now going to be the driver. And he said, "The van is going back to the hotel." And I said, "No, they're just now agreeing to release us. They're going to give us our passports back." And I was adamant about going to the rescue ship. And he took Joanne off to the side, and he said, "What you did not hear the imam say is you were to be killed and chopped up and burned." He said, "I came over here to help you because I got to know you all as good people." And he said, "I'm going to try to sneak back through the back roads and take you back to the Corinthia." And how did he know this? Because he was one of the insiders in the revolution. He was Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood. We don't know. But he risked his life to do that. And Joanne said, "You need to take my husband to the side because he's adamant about going to the rescue ship." And so he took me to the side, told me the same thing. And I said, "Okay, we go with you." And fortunately, I had enough money left that he could go down and bribe the people that were going to be paid to kill us and chop us up and burn us. And he was good to his word. He snuck us in through the back roads, got us to the Corinthia. Now, we were still on their kill list. We weren't out of Libya. But the next day, the man that was involved with the
UNIOM ship, the immigration and migration ship,
he knew one of our people. The sister of the president of Mauritania was with us. She spoke Spanish. I did also. So we communicated there. She was part of our group of seven. And she said, "I know this guy. He is Al-Qaeda, but he's a good man." And she said, "He does it probably more for the money. And he says that we should go to Benghazi because all the bad guys are now in Tripoli and that Benghazi's open.
It's empty from
Benghazi, we should be able to get from there out." And he said he would take us all the way down to the ship in his own van and get us inside the ship and make sure that we were not taken to the Egyptian, one of the Egyptian camps, refugee camps, because they would have our name there. But most probably they wouldn't in Benghazi, and they would take us to a hotel rather than take us by bus from Benghazi to the refugee center, which he did. And we were 48 hours on that ship to Benghazi. We were, of course, concerned. But when we got there, he was good to his word. We were put on in a different vehicle, taken to the Tabisti Hotel. And when we got there, there was a U.S. Consulate office in that hotel, also European Union. I went up to the office of the United States to ask for help. The guy could barely speak English. He said, "I'm not here to help Americans. I'm only here to help the rebels, and I could do nothing for you." We went upstairs to the European Union office. They said, "We'd be glad to help you, except you're not European Union. We can't do anything for you." When we got downstairs, the concierge in the hotel had decided that we didn't look like the normal riffraff that had been coming in there, and they called actually the ranking NTC man in Benghazi, who was number three in their organization. He sent his security guy in first. That man called him and said, "You need to come and meet these people." He was well-dressed, suit and tie, spoke perfect English. And according to their culture, you always try to get to know somebody by what tribe they're in. And he happened to be a member of a tribe, same tribe as a family that we got to know real well. And we mentioned their names to him. He said, "Yes, they're in our tribe, et cetera." And so that kind of opened the door. And he agreed to invite us to breakfast. It was still Ramadan. We hadn't had anything to eat or drink in 4 days. And he invited us to the buffet that night. And then he said he would use his security man to get us on an airplane that was leaving that night to take wounded soldiers to Tunisia. And he did that. And his security man stayed with us. took us to the airport, got us not only installed on the plane, but put us into the executive lounge, and then took us to the airplane, and that's how we ended up in Tunisia. Now, we happened to be traveling with some Qatari soldiers. They were majors and colonels, not generals. And the reason we know that is the prince that was with us, part of our group.
A Bahraini prince.
He recognized their dialect, and he said, these are not top-educated people, but they are middle-ranked military. When they arrived in Tunisia, they had some heavy metal frame dollies that they put down first. Then it took four of them to lift these metal-reinforced boxes about 2 foot cube. The second box had a hole in the side of it. When they tipped it, some gold buttons fell out. So they were taking their spoils home with them. What they evidently had done was melt down the gold bars to get rid of the hallmark, and that was, they were taking that back to Qatar with them. So, you know, the things that we saw with our own eyes, this is not hearsay. We are eyewitnesses to what happened. This is the reason we have been attacked by this government unmercifully. We've been soft killed and blacklisted. You know, we need people to pray for us, because really and truly God has saved us so many times that it has made us very, very spiritual since that time. And the things that have happened to us and the things that have been done have been unconscionable. But, we saw the truth and we're telling the truth.
It's the country of Libya, the people of Libya really want their country back. The people in there running that country now are not really Libyans. There may be some Libyan-born people, but there's a whole lot of mercenaries in there. And it's a real shame, because it was such a nice, peaceful, developed country, to see it being fall into this, in the hands of these criminals. And there's no talk of this on the radio at all. Every day I speak to the tribal leaders in exile, every day, and they have eyes on the ground everywhere in Libya. Yesterday I spoke to them. They said there's an attack in Sabah. There's an attack. I get all these updates every day. I know what's happening there, and they're trying to work with the neighboring countries now, because they are realizing Algeria, Niger, Chad, all of them, Egypt, they're all realizing that this infection that's inside Libya of these radical Islamists is bleeding into their countries, and they don't want it. They don't want the problems in their country, including the UAE, Kuwait, and a lot of them are now stepping up and saying something has to be done. Italy is really upset because of all the immigration that's coming out of Africa.
The refugees.
They were, Libya employed 2 million Africans before the war. They had a lot of work there for African people that came there all the time to work.
Okay, so, well, we're coming up within about 5 minutes in the program. Okay. I want to get to some other issues here.
Okay.
So now Libya is in complete chaos. It's a failed state. It's burned out. There's no reconstruction. There's a great deal of fighting. There was Egypt bombed the airport and Qatar bombed the airport. And why did they bomb the airport? What was the feedback? Suddenly, this was a couple of weeks ago when they bombed the airport. We knew that there were rebels at the airport, but what was the purpose of their attacks?
It was actually Misrata that bombed the airport.
He's talking about the other airplanes. The UAE and Egypt, they say, went in and did some unknown bombing, but they were bombing the weapons stores of these radical Islamists. They're actually supporting the Libyan people. There's been quite a few of those unknown bombing. In fact, last week they were still doing it.
What about this former top general for Gaddafi who led a group against the radicals and has been fighting?
You're talking about Khalifa Haftar.
Yes.
General Haftar was against Gaddafi, in the, I think it was the 90s, 80s. He was forming a group in Chad with the CIA to overthrow the Libyan government. The Gaddafi regime, but the Chadian government changed and did not support that anymore. So he was extracted and taken to Langley, Virginia, along with a number of his compatriots.
Lived there 20-something years.
When the false revolution started, he was dropped in to lead the military of the revolution. He led them against the Gaddafi regime, and all the Libyans know this about him. They don't follow him. They don't appreciate him. And they really don't look at him as a Libyan anymore. He is fighting Ansar al-Sharia. And they don't bother him. They let him fight Ansar al-Sharia because it's a common enemy.
What's happened in Libya, there was so much money and wealth and opportunity turned over to the hands of these radicals that they decided they own that country now, and they would now exploit that opportunity worldwide. So they, in essence, were biting the hand that was feeding them, and they made open declarations that they now had the power and wealth and income to cause radical Islam to globalize. And so the U.S., their rabid dog is starting to bite them back. And that's an unfortunate situation.
Do you have any evidence from the tribal leaders that you're in communication with now and before that what we're calling ISIS, the Islamic State, was trained or was given weapons by foreign forces in Libya?
There's many reports written all over about that.
One thing I would like to say about that is, and the Libyans tell us this all the time, and it's true, Osama bin Laden told his followers, change your name all the time because you will confuse the West. When you're talking about ISIS, when you're talking about al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda in Syria, when you're talking about Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, when you're talking about al-Qaeda, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, they're all the same. They all fight together, Muslim Brotherhood. So the use of these different names is done intentionally to confuse us. And Libya has, I don't know, three or four big training areas in Libya where they are bringing in weapons and training these mercenaries and shipping them out. They did it with Syria for a long time. So Libya is a real center of this stuff now because there's no government there. There's nothing to stop them.
I see. We're out of time. My last question is this, and it has to be a short answer. Did you approach this idea of sharing all your information with U.S. intelligence agencies with the idea that they would be open to this? Were you not at all skeptical and knowing?
Listen, we were so naive that we thought if we brought the truth to the U.S. intelligence agencies, they would find out how wrong-footed we were in Libya. And they would do something about it. That's how dumb we were.
Also, we believe al-Qaeda is our common enemy. You know, we thought we were fighting with our country against this common enemy, that if we brought this information, they would know where to go find them.
Those guys told us we were in more trouble. The men that were in our home, four different agencies said, you're in more trouble. You're in much greater danger in this country from this government than you ever when you're in the hands of al-Qaeda. And, you know, we're out here on a limb. We're flying in the wind. We need your prayers, and we need your audience to pray for us and help us go to our website.
All right,
a lot of information there.
Hold on. Which four agencies came to visit you?
Defense Intelligence Agency was first. FBI was first. FBI Terrorist Task Force was the third one. And fourth was CIA.
Okay. So right now you realize that every phone call, every email, everything you do is monitored by at least 16 federal agencies.
Yes, sure. We know that.
We know that.
We've been stopped. They've attempted to do a lot of things to us. We know that we are an asset to them. That's one of the reasons we're not dead, because they have no contact inside the tribes except us.
So they just monitor all your calls.
Sure. That's right.
Well, you better hope that there's someone on the other end answering the phone for you.
Well, you know, for that reason,
you'll be in one of those Texas barbecues.
Right, they'd lock us away.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences with us. The website is LibyanWarTheTruth.com. Their DVD is Escape from Al-Qaeda. We've been speaking during this hour with James and Joanna Moriarty, Moriarty. Thank you both very much, and hopefully the truth of your experiences and what you are aware of in the tribes of Libya will become more important to people, especially the good journalists, the Seymour Hirsches, the Glenn Greenwalds. There's a lot of good, uncompromised journalists in America. My suggestion is that you get into contact with them.
Jerry Corsi has written 35 articles based on the information we provided him, and he will verify that to everybody.
He's with WorldNet Daily, Jerome Corsi.
We've had three of the documents the Libyans have provided us have been read into the library, into the congressional record. You know, there's a lot of things that have been formed.
We don't have any more time, but my suggestion is get that legislator who you met with. and get him to have official congressional hearings where you can testify under oath, and then those agencies that will have to come in and testify under oath about the threats they made. So therefore, you'll have a chance to have confronted the people who are in these bureaucracies, the technocrats, the bureaucrats, and put them on the record. That would give you some protection, because then they would be told, you know, there's a spotlight on them. Anything happens to you, you know, all these dirty tricks have been done. Then it's in the public domain, and you have someone on your side in Congress.
You know, they can't take anything else away from us. We have to tell the truth, and the people of the United States are need to hear what we have to say.
Well, we thank you for being on and sharing this with us. All the best.
Gary, if you ever want to have us on again and have one of the tribal leaders on that speaks English, we can bring one on.
That would be a good thing, too. All the best to both of you. I'm Gary Knoll. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour.